This is McGuire on the Wire, brought to you by McGuire Sponsel. We are a national consulting firm aiming to provide facts, advice, and updates on the ever-changing world of tax law. This podcast will give you base-level information as well as high-level thought leadership on how to navigate these technical disciplines. At McGuire Sponsel, we provide unique services to our clients using an old-school, hands-on approach that is deeply respected within the CPA industry. Now stick around and listen to one of our experts. We're glad you're here.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. We're getting right up to the 9/15 deadline. By the time we publish this, I think it'll be post the 9/15 deadline. And that's brought us to think about some questions as it relates to specialty tax. The other day, I got a call from a CPA firm that we've been working with for a number of years. And they asked me a question. It is a large CPA firm, but they have a colleague who is a sole practitioner who had a cost segregation study done a year earlier for the 2017 tax year, and now we're talking about 2018. And that cost segregation study had been done on a retroactive basis. And so typically we would require a 3115 filed with a 481A adjustment. Now that practitioner had properly pushed through the 481A adjustment, but had forgotten to file the 3115. So this brought up a question and something we started bouncing around the office. And we started talking around the office, not about mistakes that specialty tax providers make. And obviously anyone who's ever talked to us knows that there are issues in the marketplace, in the specialty tax marketplace, but more about mistakes or miscommunications that are made in the implementation once the work's done. So, as I mentioned, on the cost segregation side, it could be something as simple as the cost segregation study was done correctly, led to a great result, but the CPA firm forgot to file a 3115 or something else. So I was talking to one of our engineering managers on the research tax credit side, and I said, so what do we see on the research tax credit side that's similar to this? And we started talking about it a little bit. And a lot of it on the R&D side, sometimes it becomes understanding the benefit of a research tax credit study. So for those who haven't gone through a research tax credit study, there's the credit that's calculated, but then there's an effective credit. Basically, what happens with the R&D tax credit is that there's the R&D tax credit is added back through an M1 adjustment, typically. And so that reduces the credit. So if you have a $100,000 credit calculated, the effective credit's not going to be $100,000 because of that add back. And so one of the things that we were talking about is just understanding the effectiveness of the credit, because sometimes people will sit there and go, I've got a $100,000 tax credit. I expect to get a $100,000 check in my pocket. And it's important that people understand the effectiveness of it. Now that's something that we are pretty clear about when we're proposing on work, but we have seen situations where a taxpayer has utilized another firm to do an R&D study, and the study was done correctly, all the information's there, but there was at the end of the study or at the end of the project, the taxpayer ended up being a little bit upset about the process, because they saved a decent amount of money, but the money they saved wasn't the same as what their expectation was. And so that's one of the areas that we've seen. Now, there is a way around this add back, and that's making a 280C election. Now, the 280C election still reduces the credit. Basically you're taking, effectively what the 280C election is doing is it's reducing the credit by the corporate tax rate. So for certain taxpayers, that can be a very beneficial thing. However, that 280C election can only be done on a current year return. So another area that we've seen this become an issue for taxpayers is we've actually had a situation where after a study was done, the CPA firm elected to take the 280C on amended returns. This, because it wasn't allowed to do, this created an audit situation where, because of that error, the audit situation has been ongoing for a number of years. So it's important that when we when we do these, we actually understand exactly how all these are working. So in this case, that was specifically because they didn't want to ask the taxpayer for a check because they were creating carry forwards. So in this case, if they hadn't taken the 280C election, basically they would have taken a credit. They would have had an add back. So it would actually have created some taxable income in those retroactive years to create a carry forward credit. Now, had that all been discussed up front and had the expectations been maintained, that would have ended up a lot better. It might not have gotten under audit, and it might have moved on without any issues for the taxpayer. Another area that we've seen some issues on is people not getting to utilize, on the R&D side, is people not getting to utilize the credits that are just carry forwards. Now, this was a lot more common when AMT was more prevalent, but we still see it from time to time. And really, it just requires doing the proper analysis, working with the CPA firm and the provider of the R&D tax credit to make sure that expectations are set at the beginning and understanding what the tax position is of the taxpayer when we're doing that work. So these are just some areas. It's not, as I mentioned, it's not a implication of the people doing the work on one side or another. It's just understanding how to get these things implemented to make sure that sometimes these very large credits and these things that can create a lot of goodwill, that goodwill is maintained by not making errors at the last minute. So that brings us also, obviously, those that know me know that I talk a lot more about cost segregation because that's what I understand. And that's what I do on a regular basis. So that really brings us to some of the errors that we see in the same way on the cost seg side. I mentioned earlier, about 2-3 weeks ago, I got a call from a CPA firm, and they had it. Like I said, this was not their client, but it was a client of a friendly firm who, in 2017, had done a cost segregation study on a retroactive basis. It was for a building that was originally acquired in 2005, which created, by doing this, they were able to accelerate deductions. And as people that have heard me talk before know, that basically can be pushed through on a change in accounting method with a 481A adjustment. And by doing the study, the person that did the work, as far as we know, did a quality cost segregation study, came up with a 481A adjustment of about $1 million. Now, however, there was not enough communication. The CPA firm was new to this type of analysis, and they had never filed a change in accounting method or never looked at this before. So they took that $1 million adjustment, and they correctly put it as an other adjustment on the tax return, filled out the 4562 correctly and everything else. They just forgot or didn't have the knowledge base to realize that they had to file a 3115 as well. So the question then that I was posed is, how do we fix this? And we walked through with the CPA firm how to fix it and how to get everything filed. Luckily, because it was only 1 year ago, they had not established an accounting method on that new methodology. So there's a number of ways to fix it, and we could get them straight to move forward. But it shows that there are things that need to be looked at and need to be discussed at the end of a project. Another thing that we see with cost segregation studies, it's very similar to the what I mentioned on the R&D side, where people aren't always aware of that add back on the R&D side. Same thing really happens with cost segregation, is that a lot of times people aren't really aware of some of the fact that it's a timing analysis and potential recapture issues upon sale. And that's something that really needs to be discussed at the front end so that people understand that we're not creating deductions on a cost segregation study. What we're doing is we're moving deductions from future years into today, and we're playing basically with time value of money. So in a situation where a taxpayer's planning on flipping a building after a year or so, unless they're doing a 1031 exchange or something else, it might be something that they avoid simply to avoid those recapture penalties and because it's just a timing issue. So that's another area that we see people get confused on cost segregation studies, where it although the study might generate significant savings, a year or two later they're left with a bad taste in their mouth, and we want to make sure that they don't have that. And by discussing these, they can be aware of what that is and be aware of what the savings are, and often they're happier as an end result. And they still move forward with their analysis. They still do everything they need to do, But the expectations are set at the beginning. Now, the way I relate it to some people is if I go up to somebody and say, I'm going to give you $100, obviously that person's very happy. Now, if I only give them $50, there's a loss of expectation, and that transaction doesn't have as good a feeling to them. However, if I just walked up and said, I'm going to give you $50 and gave them the $50, they'd be overjoyed. And so setting the expectations for what they're supposed to get at the beginning is very critical as it relates to cost segregation or 179D or R&D. Now, there's some other areas on the cost segregation side that we see similar things come up. Recently, we got a call about doing a cost segregation study for someone who was filing for historic tax credits. And what had happened is they had hired somebody to walk them through the historic tax credit and on the renovation of their property, and then they were calling us to do the cost segregation study. Now, luckily, we got involved early enough on that we could explain to them the issue, but the issue there is there's a balance with a historic tax credit and credit study and cost segregation. Historic tax credits can only be used against real property, where a cost segregation's the whole point of the study is to maximize personal property. So if you can only take a historic tax credit on real property renovation, so the basically what's called 1250 property or real property, the structural assets, the drywall that's not personal property and other things, and the cost segregation study's goal is to maximize personal property, whether that be carpet or cabinetry or decorative millwork, those type of things. By maximizing the personal property, we're often reducing the amount of the historic tax credit. And so there's got to be a balance. And because they had already claimed the historic tax credit, we didn't want to adjust that number by maximizing personal property. If we had done that, because this was one they needed to file a 3115 for, if they had filed a 3115 because the historic tax credit was done in 2016 and now we're on the 2018 return, we could have done that, maximized deductions on the 2018 return, filed a 481A adjustment, but that would have then adjusted the basis of the calculation for the historic tax credit, requiring them to go back and amend 2016 and reduce the amount that their tax credit was taken on. So these are things that need to be looked at in balance, and it's important that people understand where those things come in. And we walked them through it. In their case, they had already taken some personal property. It wasn't worth it to go back and open that up. But sometimes there is actually a benefit to it, especially if back in 2016, if they had qualified leasehold improvements were eligible for the historic tax credit. Now, the historic tax credit would have been reduced because you would have taken the bonus depreciation before the calculation of the tax credit. So that's one area that we also see an error. We also have run into some situations where a taxpayer wasn't aware of AMT limitations as it relates to nonprofit or government property. So for example, a taxpayer, especially with 100% bonus depreciation, goes in and purchases a office building that is then leased back to the state of Indiana. We're sitting here in Indiana. That office building is going to be subject to AMT limitations because it is required that a property leased to a government agency on a long-term lease is depreciated using AMT. Well, that means they can't get bonus depreciation. So if they were buying that property with the expectation of being able to write a lot off under the bonus depreciation regulations, that would limit their ability to take that. So it's important that we talk about what those restrictions are and make sure people understand it. They still are moving forward with the cost segregation study because there's still a benefit of accelerating those depreciation deductions into the current year and accelerating them over the next few years. They just lose the bonus depreciation and AMT slows it down a little bit, but there's still a benefit to doing it. The other thing that we see quite often, and this is probably one of the bigger issues, and we're not seeing it right now because of the expiration, but it's the understanding of how 179D works. And I'm gonna take a step back for a second and remind people of what 179D was. 179D is an expired tax provision. It was a part of the tax extenders, which I say it's expired. It's expired as of the time I'm recording this. There's still a chance that Congress puts a tax extender bill together and it gets extended. but as of right now, it's expired. And what it amounts to is it's $1.80 per square foot in deductions against the capital basis of an asset. And so we would often get calls from people who say, I just built a new warehouse. I need to take this 179D tax credit. And we'd have to explain to people that, number one, 179D is not a tax credit. It's a deduction. And number two, it reduces your basis. And so, for example, if you have a 100,000 square foot warehouse that you spend a $100 per square foot building, you spent $10 million building your warehouse. The 179D deduction would, at $1.80 a square foot, would be $180,000. What you would do is you would reduce the basis in your $10 million warehouse by the amount of that deduction, or reduce it by $180,000. And then you'd get an additional deduction, similar to bonus depreciation, that would flow through your current return. So if you're at a 30% tax rate, your net savings would be the loss of the deduction over 39 years. You would lose that, but then you would get $180,000 in deductions in 1 year. So at a 30% tax rate, your savings would amount to somewhere around $50,000 to $55,000. So significant savings, but not $1.80 a square foot in total savings. If they were assuming they would get a tax credit, they would be upset at the end result. So it was important that people understand it. Now, it's also now, with the change in some of the bonus depreciation regulations, that it became even more critical when qualified leasehold improvements were around, because lighting systems might be a qualified leasehold improvement. So we saw people in times they were leasing a building, they were leasing a warehouse, they were leasing 100,000 square foot with the warehouse, and they put in new lights, and there's a 179D deduction, and they were going to get just the lighting deduction, let's say, for 60 cents a square foot on those new lights in their 100,000 square foot warehouse. And they spend $1 per square foot putting in the new lights. So they spend $100,000. Now the 179D deduction is up to $60,000. However, qualified leasehold improvements were bonus eligible, and let's just go back to 2016, at 50%. And with a 15-year life. So those 100,000 square foot lights that they spent $1 per square foot, they spent $100,000 doing, without doing the 179D study, they're already writing off $50,000 as bonus eligible. And then they're depreciating the other $50,000 over 15 years. What the 179D is doing is up to $60,000 in deductions on top of that, but it's limited by the basis. So if they're already writing off $50,000 worth of bonus, it's important that they balance those two. So sometimes what ends up happening is the net result of the 179D study wasn't as big a dollar as the taxpayer was expecting. Once again, it still justified itself. In most cases, it was still beneficial for doing. However, sometimes the expectations were high, so they were left feeling like they got sold something that wasn't as great as they expected. In most cases, they still took a significant amount of money. So the point of what we're getting at today is it's important to manage those expectations. It's important to understand what's going on and have a communication between the specialty tax provider that has expertise and does these type of analysis on a daily basis and the person actually putting these on the tax return, the CPA firm and the client, and all need to work together to have that open line of communication. That's just one of the reasons that McGuire Sponsel, when we're working with clients, we typically work through the CPA firm so that we can have those conversations to make sure that expectations are managed and make sure that the CPA and the taxpayer and everyone involved understands where the benefits are. Because understanding where the benefits are often can lead to huge amounts of goodwill at the end of these analyses. And we want to make sure that we maintain that and grow that over the years. I appreciate everybody logging on, and I appreciate the time. I look forward to speaking with some of you in person over the coming months, and thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to McGuire on the Wire. Have a question from today's episode or interested in our team covering another topic? Reach out to us at McGuire on the Wire at McGuireSponsel.com.